Today is Tuesday, April 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as lockdown protests grow across the U.S., governors plead with the government to support their stay-at-home efforts.
Nobody deserves to lose a child or a parent or a grandparent or any loved one. And that's precisely what's at stake today.
The World Health Organization fears U.S. funding cuts will roll back health gains in Africa. Also ahead, a singing doctor proves that music is medicine. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. coronavirus death toll topped 42,000 on Monday as more protesters gathered in state capitals to demand an early end to the lockdowns. In hard-hit Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer said that last week's gathering outside the state capitol protesting stay-at-home orders put public health at risk.
The thought that COVID-19 might spread because of a big gathering like that is real. It's a concern. And while I respect people's right to dissent, I am worried about the health of the people of our state. That's what's driving every decision that I've made. None of this is easy.
Whitmer opened Monday's press briefing with a tribute to a husband and wife in Detroit who lost their 5-year-old daughter to COVID-19, Michigan's youngest victim in the coronavirus pandemic. Skylar Herbert died Sunday.
Father who has spent 18 years on the front line as a Detroit firefighter. Her mother was a Detroit police officer for 25 years. They've been on the front line and they've served with honor and integrity, and they did not deserve to lose their child to this virus. Nobody does.
600 people have died from the virus in Detroit. Skylar was one of 47 Detroit residents to die from the virus in just the past 3 days. As of Monday, the city had more than 7,700 cases. Stay-at-home measures have ground the economy to a standstill and forced more than 22 million people to apply for unemployment benefits in the last month. But a number of governors across the country say until there is enough testing in their states, the measures are essential to slowing the spread of the virus. They disputed President Trump's recent comments that Democrats are playing a dangerous political game by insisting there's a shortage of tests. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said states are still waiting.
Federal government has said from day one, don't worry, we're going to provide funding to the states. Don't worry. But I'm worried because I've heard this over and over again.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said Monday that it could take weeks, if not months, before the country's most populous city reopens due to a lack of widespread testing, even as officials elsewhere began rolling back restrictions on daily life. In Maryland, Governor Larry Hogan, who is also the chair of the National Governors Association, said the federal government has not done enough to help states get virus tests, so Maryland arranged to get 500,000 of the test kits from a South Korean company.
Equal to the total amount of testing which has been completed by four of the top five states in America combined.
On Monday, though, President Trump again countered the lack of testing, saying he's given governors lists of virus testing labs in their states and argued some just don't know their own testing capacity.
Not simply ask the federal government to provide unlimited support. I mean, you have to take the support where you have it, but we are there to stand with the governors and to help the governors, and that's what we're doing.
The United States has by far the world's largest number of confirmed coronavirus cases, with more than 774,000 infections. New reported U.S. cases appear to be slowing from about 30,000 a day from last week. Still, hotspots are emerging in cities like Chicago, Boston, and Philadelphia. President Trump and Congress are near a deal to providing the massive need of financial assistance for small businesses and hospital aid. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has details.
The Trump administration and Congress are trudging toward a deal aimed at getting more help to small businesses. The Small Business Aid Program ran out of money last week after being swamped by companies applying for loans. The new $450 billion package would get it rolling again while also adding money for hospitals and COVID-19 testing, which Democrats are demanding.
We're getting close to a deal.
The administration's hoping to get the small business program running again by midweek, but the timeline is uncertain. It's now clear there will not be a deal in time for the Senate to act this afternoon. If one can be struck by tomorrow, there could be another Senate session. The House says it could vote as soon as Wednesday, but there are logistical hurdles, since lawmakers would likely have to return here to Washington for a vote. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The head of the World Health Organization, Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, at a news conference Monday, responded to President Trump's criticism of the organization, saying that U.S. experts have been an important part of the fight since the COVID-19 outbreak began, and said experts from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had been working with them at the U.N. agency in Geneva since January. Tedros also said the World Health Organization has placed orders for 30 million diagnostic tests over the next 4 months and is shipping nearly 180 million surgical masks in April and May. President Trump suspended funding to the organization last week, but Tedros said divisions between people and political parties are fueling the pandemic. Well, the WHO is fearful that funding cuts announced by the U.S. will deter its efforts to control the spread of the coronavirus in Africa. Aside from this virus, the WHO is concerned that vaccine-preventable diseases could also spread as countries are forced to cancel vaccination programs. Simon Marks reports from Ethiopia.
President Donald Trump's decision last week to suspend U.S. funding for the World Health Organization could deter the continent's ability to stamp out not only the coronavirus, but other deadly diseases such as malaria and HIV/AIDS, a senior WHO official told VOA. The U.S. is the main funder of WHO programs linked to malaria, polio, and HIV/AIDS in Africa. Currently, the U.S. has pledged $400 million to the WHO's $4.8 billion 2020-2021 budget. While its pledges are mostly locked in for this year, WHO officials expect the U.S. funding suspension to start biting in 2021. Michelle Yao, Emergency Operations Program Manager at the WHO's Regional Office for Africa, spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
This support is what helped to provide technical support or even to have a technical position in a country. Some of them, a program like malaria, need to have a continuous support based in a WHO country office. So all this technical position and also work that is required while convening experts to work on a specific guideline for a given disease. This is also the funding was helping, and sometime even in some of the supply, maybe on the HIV issues. So all this, of course, will suffer if this gap is not covered.
For COVID-19 prevention efforts, the WHO has repurposed many of its staff to deal with the outbreak. While money has been set aside for 2020, question marks hang over those roles for next year.
In the case of COVID, some of the these technical people that has been repurposed. And, of course, most of them got the contract extended, but maybe from next year, if we don't have enough funds and we have to cut on staff, it will also affect, because some of them have been repurposed based on that. If this shortage is continues, it will definitely affect our HR plan for next year.
Yao denounced claims that the WHO was slow to respond to the coronavirus outbreak, or that the organization has been too China-centric. He said that a team of international experts was sent to Wuhan, where the original outbreak occurred, as early as January 1st to report on the scale and danger of the outbreak. The WHO, in partnership with other UN agencies, has begun delivering personal protective equipment around Africa by using Addis Ababa as its central cargo hub. World Food Programme planes last week began delivering emergency health workers across the region. But a sheer lack of basic and technical equipment such as ventilators and clinical care beds are troubling many policymakers in the region. John Nkangasong, director of the Africa CDC, told reporters last week that at least 10 countries in Africa have no ventilators whatsoever. Another major concern for health authorities in Africa is the impact the COVID-19 crisis will have on other diseases. According to the WHO, Guinea, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Chad have already postponed mass vaccination campaigns for measles that were due to take place between March and June. The WHO fears it will see vaccine-preventable diseases like measles, rubella, polio, and diphtheria become more commonplace. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The French NGO Médecins Sans Frontières, also known as Doctors Without Borders in English, says it's ended its migrant rescue partnership with a fellow charity, SOS Méditerranée, amid a disagreement over European port security. MSF told European members that the coronavirus is not an excuse to neglect the human rights of migrants at sea. International Edition's Steve Miller got details in a conversation with Paris-based reporter Nicolas Pinon.
Basically, right now, the NGO is saying that there are too many challenges for them operating in the Mediterranean Sea. You had this press release put out by MSF operations manager Anne-Marie Louf, and basically she's saying that MSF is concerned that the states are, according to her, instrumentalizing outbreak control measures to justify the violation of international law and humanitarian principles. Well, basically, what they are accusing, especially Italy and Malta, of not letting them, being in the harbors and the ports to be able to disembark the migrants that the MSF and other organizations might save in the sea. And right now what they're denouncing is that the current pandemic and the safety measures that you have in place in Europe are preventing them from saving lives.
Now, the two groups have worked in the past to bring migrants ashore. I mean, what comes to mind really is the vessel, the Ocean Viking. I mean, they've literally brought thousands of people in distress over the past years to shore. So what is the, I guess, longer reaching impact of this kind of separation?
You're absolutely right, because according to both NGOs, they saved more than 30,000 migrants over the past 4 years. And what's at stake right now is the situation of other migrants. We are on the other side, in Libya, where, as you know, the humanitarian situation is catastrophic. And according to International Organization for Migration, IOM, you have about 650,000 refugees and migrants who are waiting right now just on the other side of the Mediterranean Sea in Libya. And their situation right now is at stake. So what do you do right now? Because we know their situation is at risk. It's a war zone in Libya. You still have fightings almost daily. And you still have candidates to cross the Mediterranean Sea to be able to reach Europe. And right now, if the NGOs cannot help them when they're in distress at sea, what you're going to do with them? So that's really these people that right now are at risk because of this decision.
Has SOS Méditerranée said what it plans to do?
As of right now, there is no backup plan. They had a lot of incidents with Italian and Maltese vessels during Easter weekend. And basically, they're saying that it's too much danger for them, too many risks to be able to try to this mission to saving people. So right now, everything is in pause, and they're trying to reassess the situation to be able to maybe in a few weeks after the lockdown measures end in Europe, maybe to have come some kind of a new rescue mission.
So that's, SOS Méditerranée. What about, Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières? Have they put out any kind of alternative as to how to bring those who are in distress at sea ashore?
Not as of right now, because the last statement was as of Friday, and they did not put out a new press statement, or they did not communicate about what they intend to do in the future. But we have also to keep in mind that the summer period is also the most tempting period for migrants, because it's not cold and you might want to be able to embark a vessel to be able to join Europe. So you might want to have more migrants trying to reach Europe over the next few months.
While no country in the Middle East has been hit as hard as Iran with coronavirus outbreaks, some Arab countries urged social distancing and imposed hours of curfew. Other governments resorted to arresting people for allegedly spreading false news regarding the number of coronavirus infections or deported foreign correspondents over reporting the coronavirus spread. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Sahar Khamis, associate professor of communications at the University of Maryland, about the wide range of Arab responses to the pandemic.
I think that what you described is very accurate. There has been a wide range of responses in Arab countries, but mostly the overarching response has been a lack of transparency, lack of openness about the exact number of cases affected by the coronavirus, and even worse, cracking down on anyone who tries to discuss the topic openly or tries to cover this type of story in a way that might conflict with the official governmental narrative. And I'll just give you a few examples cited by the Committee to Protect Journalists over March and now in April 2020. For example, the Iraqi regulator has suspended Reuters' license for 3 months over a COVID-19 report. Iraqi Kurdish authorities called for the closure of NRT broadcasters' television station over a COVID-19 report. Jordan arrested two Roya TV journalists over COVID-19 coverage. Bahrain puts one of the imprisoned journalists in solitary confinement over reporting on COVID-19 danger. And Egypt suspended the license of a Guardian reporter and expelled her from the country. Her name is Ruth Michelson, over a story that she has written for The Guardian in which she cited the results from a study done by a Canadian university that cited a much higher number of COVID-19 cases in Egypt compared to the ones which were mentioned officially by the government. So what are we seeing here? We are seeing a very harsh response from many Arab governments, cracking down on journalists, on press freedom, on the ability of these journalists to do their job or to report on the dangers of COVID-19 and the actual numbers that are being impacted by it. That's why I said the overarching overall response has been a type of lack of transparency and also controlling the media and controlling journalistic coverage of the crisis.
Any examples of education for the public and infectious virus awareness spreading among the audience?
Actually, some of the countries in the Gulf, including the Emirates and Qatar, have had some good reporting in terms of trying to be effective in conveying information on a daily basis for the public and also trying to put some very good safety measures in place on a continuous, consistent basis. Of course, the Gulf countries are more affluent in terms of their economic resources, and they've used some of these resources very effectively in order to try to keep the public informed about what is going on and keeping track also of public safety measures. Things like stay-at-home orders are enforced very strictly and are monitored continuously by the government.
How about spreading false advice? And in some reports I saw some journalists claiming that, for example, Egypt is leading the world in fighting this coronavirus.
This is another problem. You know, Egypt has actually issued like a law that actually says that if you report any information that is between two brackets, quote-unquote, false information about COVID-19, you can really face legal consequences. And the result is, you know, I'm a frequent guest on BBC Arabic television, for example, and oftentimes when I go on air, I hear people, you know, commenting from Egypt, and they would say, you know, but please don't mention my name. Or the reporter says, but, you know, this person has to be anonymous. You know, these can include, you know, whether they're journalists, whether they are doctors, nurses, other people. They're afraid to actually have their name out there in public for fear of legal consequences and legal repercussions. So, again, this is part of the overall picture I've been talking about when I said the lack of transparency and control and trying to control the narrative, really, of what is going on and to make sure it is crafted, very well crafted, by the regimes in power, not by any other agency or any other party.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. A black market has developed in Russia for an antiviral HIV drug explored as a possible treatment for COVID-19, the respiratory disease caused by the new coronavirus. According to sellers, HIV activists, and the head of the drug's main Russian producer, more than 20 trials around the world are testing Keletra as a COVID-19 treatment or post-exposure prophylaxis. Spain's health ministry on Monday said the number of people diagnosed with the new coronavirus in that country has surpassed the 200,000 threshold. Spain has the second highest number of diagnosed cases in the world after the United States. China's health authority has called for a stronger and more rigorous testing regime to assure that the new coronavirus does not escape detection, whether in travelers arriving from abroad or from other parts of the country. All localities, it said, must improve their testing capabilities, including those at border crossings, and report any epidemic information in a timely manner. Stay with VOA for all the latest world news.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.
Oil prices went negative Monday, a first ever for the markets. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
The price for May delivery of a barrel of U.S. benchmark crude oil fell below zero to a negative $37.60 as traders scrambled to dump the contracts because storage capacity is nearly at its limit in the U.S. Other contracts for later deliveries also fell, but not below zero. The market's fall has been dramatic. In January, the price was close to $60 a barrel. That was before the coronavirus forced a shutdown of businesses and retailers and all the cars and vehicles used by those companies and their customers. I'm Tim McGuire.
Sunday marked 10 years since the Deepwater Horizon BP oil spill on the Gulf Coast of the United States. The deadly disaster is considered the largest marine oil spill in the history of the industry, with a U.S. estimate of 4.9 billion barrels having spilled into the Gulf of Mexico. The tragedy was one of the largest environmental disasters in American history. Joining us now to talk about the impacts and what, if any, changes were implemented to ensure it never happens again is Diane Hoskins, campaign director with Oceana, the largest international advocacy organization dedicated to ocean conservation. Thank you for being with us. First of all, just tell us about the impacts from this spill.
The BP Deepwater Horizon disaster caused economic and environmental devastation. It killed 11 rig workers. It spewed more than 200 million gallons of oil into the Gulf. Tens of thousands of birds, sea turtles, dolphins, and fish died. It was horrific. The environmental impact of the disaster was absolutely unprecedented. For more than 5 years, more than 75% of all dolphin pregnancies resulted in miscarriages, stillbirths, or newborn deaths. The Gulf of Mexico's Brutus whales, one of the most endangered whales in the world, their population decreased by as much as 20%. As many as 800,000 birds died, including up to 32% of laughing gulls and 12% of brown pelicans. Up to 170,000 sea turtles were killed by the disaster. About 8.3 million oysters died. Certain fish, shrimp, and squid decreased by as much as 85%. These impacts were catastrophic for the seafood industry. People stopped fishing. People stopped buying Gulf seafood. They didn't trust it. That resulted in major economic consequences for the seafood industry, as much as $1 billion lost for that industry.
We would see these birds just soaked in oil that being rescued and people trying to save them. How well has the area, the beaches, the wildlife, and the fishing industry recovered from all of that? Or are they still feeling the impacts?
The disaster had catastrophic impacts on ecosystems, communities, and economies. And unfortunately, many of those impacts are still being felt today. A recent study showed that the seafloor near the wellhead is still barren of life that's typically found there. A study that just came out last week studied thousands of fish. It found oil in every single one of the fish tested. Some of the wetlands that were killed by oil will never recover because when the plants die, the land is washed away with it. And some marine mammal populations may take decades to recover if they do. too. Unfortunately, it's horrific, the impacts the disaster had and how much communities and the ecosystem is still feeling today.
What has been done to mitigate something like this from happening again?
Well, what we know is that offshore drilling is still dirty and dangerous, just as much so as it was 10 years ago. No offshore operator can say to you that this will not happen with certainty. If anything, another disaster is more likely as the oil industry drills deeper and farther offshore in riskier places. Instead of learning from the BP disaster, President Trump is actually proposing to radically expand offshore drilling to new areas. Many folks studied the disaster and made a lot of hard recommendations to industry, said that radical transformation was needed of their safety culture. We've seen the oil industry fight against the safeguards that are needed. And not only has industry fought increases in safety, President Trump has actually rolled back some of the far too few safeguards that were put in place. Things like a second set of eyes when testing is happening, reducing the frequency of testing, common sense measures. We learned during the disaster that the industry could not be trusted to self-police. So as of today, offshore drilling remains dirty and dangerous, and the industry's record is still unacceptable. At least 7,000 oil spills occurred in U.S. waters between 2007 and 2018. It's not just the spills that continue. Too many offshore workers are still dying or getting injured on the job. Over that same period, there were 48 fatalities, over 3,000 injuries, and on average, a fire or explosion erupts every 3 days.
What about the business owners and the people in the communities living along the Atlantic and other coastal areas? How are they seeing this potential expansion of oil drilling?
Opposition to offshore drilling on the East and West Coast is strong. Policymakers, business owners, communities up and down the Atlantic and Pacific coasts agree. Expanded offshore drilling is not wanted or needed. And now it's time for President Trump to listen.
Diane Hoskins, campaign director with conservation organization Oceana. With the wider world off limits to those practicing physical distancing, new bonds are forming closer to home. In communities around the world, neighbors are now doing curious things like hunting for teddy bears and joining in evening rituals to honor frontline workers. Matt Dibble looks at one community in Oakland, California.
For more than a month, Californians have been asked to remain at home, with only rare and local outside trips permitted. Many neighbors are reaching out to each other with creativity and compassion for parents confined with young children. The daily walk is liberating.
Where's the bear? There it is.
In this Oakland neighborhood, furry faces reward sharp eyes, like those of Brendan Moriarty and his daughter Eloise.
Where is it? Where is it? There are bears everywhere and windows, and it's fun looking for them, right? Do you like looking for bears?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Emmy Hoffmeister and her daughter, Ivy, are also joining in.
I saw people that were posting pictures of their bears in their windows, and I realized that it was a thing. That night, we put a bear in our window, and we went and looked around the neighborhood to see how many bears we could find.
How many bears have you found, Ivy?
10.
So-called teddy bear hunts have sprung up in many other cities, too. To entertain and reassure those who might find the world a little scary right now.
Ivy, when you see the bears in the windows, how does it make you feel?
Happy.
In cities, many now have a nightly salute to healthcare workers. This is one community among many where strengthened bonds seem certain to outlast the pandemic. Matt Dibble for VOA News, Oakland, California.
Broken down and tired.
Dr. Elvis Francois, an orthopedic surgery resident, has gone viral with his live performance at hospitals. 2 years after becoming an unlikely singing sensation, the 34-year-old doctor with a golden voice is releasing his first ever EP this Friday, and all of the proceeds will be donated to the Center of Disaster Philanthropy COVID-19 Response Fund.
And I rise up high like the waves. I rise up in spite of the ache. I rise up
times again.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Mwangangye, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care and be well.